Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Technology has changed the American economy significantly over the past 40 years, but it won't take that long before artificial intelligence is impacting how we live and especially work in the future. One of the big concerns is whether AI will replace humans in the workplace and what that means for workers. On Smart Talk today, we discuss artificial intelligence and what impact it could have on jobs. Joining us is Dr. Stephen Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center. Dr. Herzenberg, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Also joining us is John McElligott, who is the CEO of York Exponential. Mr. McElligott, welcome to the show.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. And Dr. Vasant Hanover, a Penn State AI Research Lab Director, and he's Chair of Penn State's Information Sciences and Technology. Dr. Hanover, welcome to the show as well.
Glad to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. If you would like to leave a question or comment on Facebook, you can do it on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I'm going to start with a broad question. And John McElligott, let me ask you, in broad terms, what impact has artificial intelligence had on jobs and will have on jobs in the future?
Yeah, so I think one of the probably the big differences between artificial intelligence and maybe the previous generations of automation is some of the impact is going to be felt in also white-collar jobs. So in the past, we've had like robotics come in. Manufacturing has used them pretty extensively, and so it's always impacted some of the blue-collar jobs. I think this will probably be the first time that some of the higher-level jobs, you know, college graduates are going to be impacted, whether it's in finance, healthcare. But this is really just the beginning. It's going to be the blending of artificial intelligence with physical technology as well. Self-driving cars, robots, that's where we're going to see a lot of the impact that we can't right now necessarily anticipate. But whatever is going to happen, we can guarantee that every job will be impacted in some way. It doesn't mean people are going to lose their jobs, but artificial intelligence and robotics will definitely impact every part of human life.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Hanover, let me ask you your thoughts on the same question, how we have been impacted and what, in broad terms, what the future looks like.
Well, I mean, I think I agree with what was said earlier. I think, you know, by some accounts, almost 60% of the jobs or more have in at least 30% of the work that could be changed by automation. And, you know, by some accounts, about 5% of the jobs it could be completely automated. The rest of the jobs are likely to be partially automated, which means that it would be humans working alongside machines. There's probably going to be new types of jobs that are going to be created, as always has been the case when new technologies are introduced. You know, one can go back to the Industrial Revolution and think about all the jobs that came into existence after early manufacturing was automated.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, you said one thing I'm curious about. You said about 5%. Does that 5% mean those 5% of jobs will be eliminated?
So, I mean, these are just, you know, projections. So this is from a McKinsey report and that was about a year ago, and they estimated that about less than 5% of all occupations can be automated entirely using technologies, AI technologies that can be anticipated as of now.
Mm-hmm.
But the same report also found that about 60% of all occupations have at least 30% of work that could be automated. And the numbers vary between depending on which group is doing these estimates, but it's conceivable that the majority of the jobs would be impacted in some fashion. It's not that they will be entirely eliminated, but they would change in dramatic ways, some more dramatically than others, which means that nature of professions will change. So if you're a physician, the way you go about practicing medicine would change. If you're a teacher, the way you can go about education
right.
would change.
Well,
if you're
we'll talk about the specifics in just a moment. Keystone Research Center, Stephen Herzenberg, you put out a project, you're working on a project called The Future of Work, and you just filed the first report. When I say filed, I don't know if you filed it or not, but you put out the first report. What's the purpose of this project?
We were asked about 18 months ago by the Heinz Endowments in Pittsburgh, which invests significantly in, among other things, higher education in Pittsburgh, including Carnegie Mellon University. And so Heinz's perspective is that they and Pittsburgh and CMU are contributing to the development of technologies that could be disruptive. And so they felt a sense of responsibility to be at what they call an epicenter for solutions around making sure that artificial intelligence and robots, the next generation of technologies, end up creating a better society. You know, not just making tech entrepreneurs billionaires, but so that's why they reached out to us. I mean, there is a growing community of researchers in the academy and in think tanks that are looking at these issues. So we've been working closely with folks at MIT and at University of California, Berkeley. But yeah, so that's we took this on, and again, one of our conclusions is sort of in line with what our two other guests have said, which is, on the one hand, these technologies will have a broader impact in not just in manufacturing, but in a range of white collar jobs, and over the course of time, a pretty high proportion of jobs. But there'll also be job creation. And again, one of our conclusions is that there is a range in terms of predictions, but the most extreme predictions around job loss, in addition to being vague, are somewhat overblown. And so, I mean, to us, that's good news that we have some time to consider how these technologies diffuse and to work together on the critical issue of making sure that they benefit society as a whole.
When you say overblown, Steve, what do you mean by that? And Dr. Hanover, I want to come to you, too, because I know that you have said that you think that a lot of this has been hyped, and I don't know whether overblown is the right word, but I'll come to you in a moment. Steve, what do you mean by overblown?
Well, so again, I mean, I'm actually going to use the title of a book from the 1990s. A guy called Jeremy Rifkin wrote a book at that point called The End of Work. And so there's a certain part of the future of work literature, a famous study done by some Oxford University folks several years ago, that leaves you with the impression that with a fair amount of confidence, you know, not just the 5% that the professor talked about, but sort of big swaths of jobs are just going to disappear. And that's what we think is overblown. Again, our basic view is also that those kinds of predictions are very difficult to make. I mean, would you believe a weather forecast for 6 months from now? No, neither would I. And so I think that predicting the scale of displacement of current jobs and tasks within jobs from AI and robots is like gazing into foggy crystal balls. And so we think we're deliberately trying to reorient the debate to, there's going to be disruption, it's going to be broad, especially on a longer time frame. So we need to prepare to help folks manage that disruption and come out on the back end, not like the deindustrialized third class in other cities after manufacturing began to go downhill in the early 1980s. We have to do better than we've done in the U.S. in the past, dealing with the destruction that comes with innovation.
I don't know. History is always a big part of this show, and Steve, I just find it fascinating that you went back to the ice ages of the 1990s when we're talking about this.
But the vanilla ice ages.
There we go. Dr. Hanover, like I said, I understand that you also feel that some of these predictions of gloom and doom for future workers have been overblown.
So, I mean, I would say that, you know, I would agree with what has been said. I think there will be disruption. There is no question about that. There will be changes in the nature of work. There will be some jobs that would be that would probably be eliminated. There'll be other jobs that would change their character dramatically. There'll be new jobs that will be probably created. And so there is a, you know, there is a challenge that we have of managing this transition and helping people, you know, as a society. Now, this is not a technological question. It's more of a policy and a societal values question. How do we manage this transition so that the advances in technology benefit the society more broadly and not just result in improved productivity, which doesn't necessarily translate into jobs, we know that. And, you know, some companies might do extremely well as a result of this technological advance, but leave the society behind. And we want to avoid, as a society, I think we want to avoid that.
I want to talk more about that. Go ahead, John. What were you
saying? Yeah, I was just going to hop in real quick. So I think there seems to be a common theme here that we can't predict the future, which I would agree
That's
with.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
But one of the big things I think we need to focus on is not just being prepared, but making sure that the future is evenly distributed. So the reality is this. So I'm in York right now. We're a very small city. I've traveled to very small cities across the United States. And the third industrial revolution, mobile technology, the internet, we missed it completely. I mean, the reality is lots of places thrived with that technology. It did not help us. I mean, it was how we prepared, how we looked at it. So some of these technologies have obviously the potential to change everything. I mean, go back to 1890, if we're going to talk about history. You know, the 1990s, let's go to 1890. Imagine if you were going to tell someone they could fly.
Right.
They'd slap you in the face, right? I mean, it sounds crazy, but within their lifetime, that happened. And it changed a whole bunch of other things. I think the key for this is not just that the technology is going to change everything, but that we need to make sure nobody gets left behind. I mean, the first industrial revolution, you know, being out in a field and then working in a factory, that's really not that different. There's a lot of repetition. There's a lot of the same things over and over. So while new jobs will be created, if there isn't a fertile ground in our communities across the United States to be prepared to take advantage for that, it's not going to be like a one-to-one like it was in the first industrial revolution, where we went from working in fields to factories. The jobs of the future are going to look very, very different. So if we don't start aggressively preparing right now, lots of small communities will be left behind. I mean, I saw it happen in New York with the iPhone. I saw it happen with the internet. I saw it happen with web and mobile technologies. So there's no real reason for me to believe that we're going to capitalize on robotics and AI if we didn't capitalize on mobile and the internet.
Mm-hmm. Before we go any further, we probably should have done this right up front, but define what AI is, artificial intelligence. I mean, we're using this terminology. A lot of people, they have used the terminology of automation, and I think that's what a lot of people, and robotics, a lot of people have images in their mind. But how is AI defined, John?
So, I mean, this is probably a better question for Dr. Hanavar, but I mean, when we look at artificial intelligence and most people think about it, they tend to wrap it in with like the movies, right?
Right,
so artificial
right,
general yeah. intelligence, which is very far off if I don't know if we'll ever get it. Mainly what we're talking about today is narrow artificial intelligence. So it's designed to do very specific tasks. From our perspective, because we're a robotics company, the AI that we use is mostly computer vision. It allows our robots to make sense of tasks they're doing, but not the same way you and I would make sense of tasks. It just allows them to be more effective at very specific applications. But the larger impact in narrow AI probably will not be very specific narrow. It'll be combinations of lots of narrow AI using 5G or cloud technology and like self-driving cars, things like that. But I think this probably is a better question for some of the guests that specialize in artificial intelligence.
Okay, Dr. Hanover, what about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think AI broadly is about, one aspect of AI is understanding intelligence, which is a scientific question. A second aspect of AI is automating. And the way you understand intelligence is by automating different tasks that are believed to require intelligence if they are performed by humans. And that leads to technologies that we are talking about that, when deployed, will lead to automation of many tasks that are currently performed by humans. It may not be completely automated, but it may be, we're talking about technologies that would work alongside humans. And it's true that most of the successes of AI that you see in the popular literature have been in fairly narrow domains. Outside that domain, or if the conditions of the task change in unpredictable ways, most AI systems would fail. So, at the very least, even when tasks are automated using AI, you would need some people working alongside AI to make sure that you know, some of the bad consequences don't occur. Mm-hmm. But that said, in terms of the future, I mean, I think there is attempts to kind of take what has been learned by automation in very narrow domains and try to develop systems that are more robust, that can deal with, you know, increasingly more complex situations, deal with less predictable environments, and so on. And that's a, you know, topic of current research. Whether we will ever get to general intelligence, it's not even clear what that means. I mean, are we talking about general intelligence in the sense that intelligence exhibited by humans?
That, yeah, that robots can't think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that, yeah. Right. But, you know, there are many ways to be intelligent.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me get back to that. I want to bring Steve Herzenberg in.
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead, Steve.
Well, I mean, I think I agree again with both of our guests. I mean, the basic idea is artificial intelligence to some extent mimics people's sort of apparent thinking ability. So it can beat someone at Jeopardy, or it can win a game of chess, or slightly more.
I don't think they'll be able to host talk shows.
Well, I think
not like you.
I think you'll be one of the last to go.
I hope so.
You know, or drive a truck. But I mean, John used the term narrow, and that's the point here. Machines don't actually, I mean, we don't fully understand how people think, right? People have this amazing context knowledge that about lots of different domains. And so, and frankly, again, people have not had any experience, most people, of how to react when a deer jumps in front of their car at night. But again, people actually, if that happens, will to some extent, you know, react and sometimes get it right. So, so machines don't currently mimic how people think. They basically follow rules. I mean, as computers get more and more powerful, they have more ability to make the rules more and more complicated, and the machines can also assimilate massive amounts of information. So they can read 100,000 X-rays and then do better than most radiologists in terms of interpreting those X-rays, right? So both these folks have talked about, in passing, about the idea we're a long way from machines that have general intelligence. So the AI that wins at chess isn't going to be able to drive a vehicle for a while yet. So, again, nobody rules out anything if you go far enough forward. But that is, analytically, this is part of why some of the fears of job displacement are overblown. Because many jobs involves taking advantage of people's context knowledge, and that's why you as a talk show host are okay.
Okay, well that's good. Can you hold on just 1 minute?
Sure.
I got to do a break here, and this is something we have automation systems that do this. By the way, you're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamont. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about artificial intelligence and what it means to the job market, the work of the future, here on WITF Smart Talk today. Our guest, John McGilligott, who is CEO of York Exponential, Stephen Herzenberg, Executive Director of Keystone Research Center, and Dr. Vasant Hanover, Penn State AI Research Lab Director. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, the three of you we've established what AI is in broad terms. We've talked about what the future looks like. But let's talk about some realities as well. And that is that we are in a free market, that we live in a free market system, and that there are employers that will look at this and say, you know what, I can buy or I can, you know, invest in an AI system, a robotic system for, and I'm just throwing a number out there, $100,000, which will be permanent, as opposed to paying workers, you know, $50,000 every year, maybe multiple workers. In the long run, I can save money. So what's to stop that from happening in a free market? Who wants to jump in on this one?
I mean, that's...
I can take that if you like. I mean, I think what would stop that, I mean, it wouldn't completely stop that, but I think what needs to be kept in mind is that, you know, a point that was made earlier by somebody else on the show, that at the moment or in the foreseeable future, most jobs that are performed by humans require skills that are not easy to automate. So even if somebody is doing a task in a what we normally think of as a narrow domain, like being a sales clerk at a Target, right? They are bringing to bear on their job many aspects of context, general knowledge, what one might call general intelligence, to deal with their narrow domain, and that would be extremely hard to automate. So what we can envision is a situation, the best case scenario is you have human-machine systems that work together in complementary ways, with the humans complementing what the machines are good at and the machines complementing in areas where humans are weak. And that, so instead of thinking about AI as a technology that's primarily about automation, we should be thinking about AI as a technology about augmenting and extending human capability.
But Dr. Hanover, let me interrupt for just one second. Using your example, sales clerk at Target or any other department store or retail store, I mean, that's already happening where you have people who have self-checkout. And, I mean, there are a lot of people who encourage, don't use the self-checkout because you're taking jobs away from human beings. Plus, that example, or maybe you're just using an example, is, you know, I'm not saying that's a low-paying job, but that's not the kind of family-sustaining middle-class jobs that we'll need in the future.
Understood. So, but let's say the checkout is automated, right? I mean, it can be automated. But somebody walks into the store and they're asking about some product.
Right.
Maybe hard to find, or, you know, the even figuring out what a customer might want, right? I mean, on average, in a large scale, you can do that. But I think when it comes to, you know, an 80-year-old woman walks into the store and she's trying to figure out, you know, where to find something, I don't think we have AI technology that can help her.
Mm-hmm. Right? I understand what you're saying. Steve, what were you going to jump in?
And again, this is gets back to the issue of policy, or gets to the issue of policy.
And that's what we want to get to.
In the end, if this technology spreading is a form of productivity growth. At least within limits, the faster productivity growth is, potentially the faster our living standards can grow, or the faster the work week can shrink and we can have more leisure and more time for education and our families. You know, so it's back to, we have to manage it. Our take on this is that, again, the pace of technological change and displacement is not going to be so unprecedented, at least for the next several decades, that the getting the policies right is something we could do. The big question is whether getting the policies right is what we will do. And I feel a little bit like I should throw it to John here, because he's been wanting to talk a little bit more concretely, I think, about this issue of augmentation. So,
Hold on just 1 second, John. Steve, I want to follow up on. No, that's fine. I like it when
I don't usually take your job.
I know. I like it when everybody jumps in. You know, the shows I speak the least are the best ones. No, but just to follow up on that, and of a free market situation. And are you advocating that government take a bigger role in this to make sure that humans continue to have those kind of jobs?
Absolutely. Again, as you know, and I hope a lot of folks in the audience know, in the end, the notion of a free market is silly. It's that there is no free market. We have a market that's governed by property rights, a market that's incredibly dependent on investment in infrastructure, a market including innovation that's incredibly dependent on government investment, a lot of it funneled through the Defense Department. And so, again, the issue is not whether we have policy or not. You know, the choice is not between free market versus having policies. We have policies. The issue is, do we get the policies that are complementary to a strong economy and ensure, again, the broad distribution of the benefits of new technology and give people, if they need to reskill several times during a lifetime, then give people the ability and the tools they need to do that successfully. Again, that's...
Is that government's job?
Yeah.
As far as retraining?
Absolutely. Government, yeah. And there are certainly most other countries, advanced countries, invest a lot more. I mean, Denmark invests nearly 30 times as much in helping workers who lose jobs, including to retrain and get a new family-sustaining job. So, you know, if we continue to be, you know, tied with Mexico or in the same neighborhood as Mexico in terms of how much we invest of our very large economic pie in helping those folks who are displaced by technologies, then we're not going to do better in terms of the impacts for families and communities. I mean, Western Pennsylvania was creamed in the early 1980s. It lost population. A lot of workers saw their lifetime incomes cut in half when they lost that unionized steel industry job. The nature of Western Pennsylvania politics still today reflects the anger and the sense of betrayal, and New York possibly to a lesser extent, from that traumatic experience. We think we can do a lot better than that, and we think we need to the extent that these technologies ultimately are going to have a broad impact, we need to do a lot better.
And actually Pittsburgh is a success story of, you know, a city that was known for steel making that now has reinvented itself, eds and meds, education and technology as far as...
Yeah, to some extent, downtown Pittsburgh is. If you went to Aliquippa or the name other mill towns...
I said Pittsburgh. Okay? All right. John, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple points here. So I totally agree with the other guests that augmentation, we need to stop saying automation. We need to focus on augmentation. This idea that every job is going to be touched, but that humans working with robots and artificial intelligence can extend capacity, and quite frankly, extend capacity is a necessity because there will be new industries that are created that we can't even imagine. So this idea that we need to focus on just what we have now, this is actually one of my big fears, and we run into this. If a job can be automated and can go away, it should. I mean, we've had a lot of people that say robots are going to take people's jobs. If a robot can do it, it means a person's been doing a robot's job. I mean, the human mind is incredible. I mean, there are amazing things we can accomplish. But if we're doing something that's repetitive over and over and over, the truth is our children's brains are shaped differently now. I mean, they absorb information very quickly. The smartphone has reshaped their mind. You're not going to get them doing a repetitive task over and over. I don't know how many employees we talk to or employers that try and make the argument that the problem is millennials are lazy or that kids are lazy. Like, that's not the problem. I admire a lot of the folks that have done those jobs, but they're hard jobs. Like, and you know, for a robot, we have to maintain them. So it's not an easy job for a human being to do for 40 years. So as this next generation comes in and some of these jobs can be augmented or automated completely, we need to focus on making sure that people don't get left behind instead of trying to do our best to hold on to what's there. Quite frankly, one of my big fears is in places, very small communities like I'm in, very often we think we're being innovative when we're being imitative. So we have some initiative that mimics some community from 10 years ago that was good for them, and we think that's going to prepare our kids for the future, when very often, you know, we're preparing to work at Facebook in 2013, not understanding that some of these technologies we're talking about are going to look drastically different as the digital and physical worlds collide. Now, that's an incredible opportunity. I agree with both our guests. Like, we don't know what the future is going to hold, but if we pivot correctly and we view it within the right context, this could be an incredible opportunity for everyone. Or it could be something that we missed the boat completely, like small towns in Pennsylvania did
That's a big fear. Retraining. I asked another guest about retraining, and you have some knowledge about this. What about retraining? I mean, and you said about working in a factory for 40 years. I mean, even my generation probably didn't do that. I don't know what the average now is number of job changes that an adult goes through in America today.
It's a lot, yeah.
But my parents' generation, yeah, there was a time where you could, right out of high school, get a job in a steel mill and work there till you were 65, retire with a good pension, and all those kind of things. That doesn't happen very often, if at all, right. anymore. So workers are going to have to be retrained. I mean, if I can make a comparison, right now I hear it every day about the employers of today that are having trouble finding skilled workers.
Right.
And it would, I think it's concerning that if we're even having that problem today, that if there's advanced technology in the future, that retraining could be an issue.
Yeah, so I think one of the key things to look at here is when we say worker or employers are having a hard time finding skilled workers, I think the thing we have to look at is what is the skill they're looking for? Because very often, you're not going to get kids to want to learn to do that. They're just not. Now, but in a lot of ways, so for example, we have welding robots that we use. Welders are in incredible demand. A lot of the kids don't want to weld. There are the older generation that are experienced welders. So we're using our robots to augment the current workforce. So the way you program our robots, you don't need to know computer programming. A welder can weld with that robot, and the robot will learn from the welder. So what we're trying to do is really double down on augmentation. This idea of if you need five welders, but you can only find one, how do you use four robots to make that one welder five times more productive? So in the short term, we can piggyback on the existing skills as we transition. The big focus for us, and we didn't talk about it yet, is I'm also the president of the Fortress Academy. So we're licensed by the state of Pennsylvania. First of our kind, it's all accelerated education in artificial intelligence and robotics. But our main goal is to create the first generation of robot mechanics. So people that are good with their hands. We view two workforces. One is a robotic and one is a caretaker workforce. So as the robots get put into different places, they can't install themselves, they can't program themselves, they can't maintain themselves. They're going to need a whole nother generation. And quite frankly, when the kids walk through our facility, I mean, they think it's Iron Man, right? Like they're the Avengers generation. So they're incredibly excited to work with the technology. There isn't that fear. And we found in a lot of ways, if you want to convince the parents in the older generation, if you can get the kids and the kids get excited, turn them into the evangelists.
Can I have a, throw a butt in here?
Go ahead.
That you had, using your math, you said you had five welders, one human, four AI. Aren't those four humans being replaced, though?
No, because quite frankly, go by any welding facility and it's welders needed.
I mean, I understand that, but those jobs are also, I mean, right now there's a move in the state legislature to create more technical training programs because those are good paying jobs. Professor Hanover, I hear you back here. What did you want to say?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it's, I completely agree with the retraining and everything that has been said, but I would go one step further. It's not just about retraining, it's about changing the way we educate, starting from, you know, very early age, because we have to prepare kids to learn all through their lives, you know, the jobs that you could work on. This idea that you would go to college or you'd go through some vocational training, get some training, and then you can find a job and work at that job for the rest of your life, or even for 20 years, is gone. So you have to have this entirely sort of, you know, different mindset that you're learning all the time through your life, adapting to new work situations and learning new skills. And I agree. I mean, I think there is a skills gap, but the skills gap, you know, in some cases is, as was pointed out, I mean, jobs that nobody wants to do. In other cases, jobs that require a fair amount of education and training, which people don't have. So on both ends of the spectrum, we have this problem.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're discussing artificial intelligence and what it means for the future of the workforce, jobs, careers. A lot of things to think about. Our guest today, Dr. Vasant Hanover, he's a Penn State AI Research Lab Director, John McElligott, who is the CEO of York Exponential, and Stephen Herzberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Nathan in Chambersburg. Nathan, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Yeah, I work at a larger financial services company, and we're starting to get into RPA, robotic process automations, and they have me leading a couple of the projects. And I have, I guess my question is, how do you reconcile a kind of uneasy feeling knowing that you're working on something that might eventually put your coworkers out of work?
Thank you very much for your call. And I know that there are other people that have had this same thought, that when you're kind of training the robot, you may be training someone's replacement. What do you say to that?
Yeah, so I think a big focus of this, and this is actually a big push for us, so we have five specific S's, and one of them is social impact. We can learn a lot of lessons from recent technological advances. Facebook, Google, which is now Alphabet, there are a lot of things that they did that I believe they knew there would be positive and negative repercussions, and I think there was a feeling that of just riding it out. I think probably technology companies now, and we have this close to our heart, need to be the first generation of responsible disruptors. Like understanding that the technology we are developing will have an impact, but if we have people at the core and people at the center, and we can work with government, all the way from the president down to local mayors, we do have an incredible opportunity as long as we have this idea of responsible disruption. But we should not fool ourselves that the technology that we're developing won't have an impact, but it's also an opportunity to make sure no one gets left behind. Actually, for the first time, I mean, technology has always had winners or losers. We could actually, if we were deliberate with this, make sure that everyone is included. But part of this is a conversation and understanding that it's actually happening. But it can't just happen at the White House. It can't just happen in think tanks, which is why this discussion on air with you today is so important, to get regular people to think about how will this impact my job, how will it impact my kids, and quite frankly, how it should impact the way I vote.
But, okay, not disagreeing with you. I'm going to be the cynical one here. Ask the cynical question.
Go ahead.
300 million plus people. Let's face it, the political atmosphere we are in right now, you can't get people to agree. It's snowing outside. I don't know if that's snow or is that freezing rain. I don't know.
Right.
A bad example. But anyway, who is going to be the responsible one? Who is going to take that social responsibility? Steve, your organization, I guarantee there are people listening here today who are in the know and say Keystone Research Center represents unions. So they have an agenda here. That's the view that people will take, that some people will take, rather than hearing what you're saying about what's good for the future.
Some people react that way. Again, our mission is pretty anodyne. You know, we are committed to a more prosperous and equitable Pennsylvania. I think actually,
but what you just said just made a lot of people mad because they say, "I know where he's coming."
They don't want to. Well,
I actually think, you know, see what I'm saying. They will disagree for the sake of disagreeing.
Fair enough. But it's not all bad. I mean, there are. I think recently there have been, as far as I was concerned, last November, there were some useful changes in our politics. And there's John and I were talking before we came on air. The kinds of changes that we think are needed require some kind of social movement in the U.S. I mean, right now, there's been a big reaction against economic inequality. There's more discussion of wealth inequality in the last year than there has been. There's this sense that if we're going to have innovation in our economy, that too much of that money is going to a few people at the top. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we would say that doesn't make sense on the merits, because we've collectively invested taxpayers' money in foundational technologies. And also we would say that, and we do say in our report that's online at www.keystoneresearch.org towards an AI economy that works for all.
We'll have a link to that on our website.
All right. We talk about the fact that innovation is actual. A lot of innovation is incremental and involves lots of people, and it doesn't just involve a few smart engineers and entrepreneurs, right? So bottom line is, in the end, yeah, we think you have to win political arguments. I mean, you talked before about the free market, and Pennsylvania politics and national politics are still partly in this way of ideologies and philosophies that have been strong in the United States forever, but particularly since the early 1980s and the presidency of Ronald Reagan. And again, from our point of view, unless we have to win the arguments for the need for government to partner with our fantastic economy on making these changes beneficial to everybody. So from our point of view, and again, if you read our report, I think you'll pick this up. We invest enormously in technological innovation. If we invested a fraction in social innovation, giving states, giving small cities, you know, a chance to innovate around retraining systems, or from my point of view, worker voice. You know, I mean, it's given the creativity in this country, we could get this stuff right, and it would create a to die for world. And so we have to convince enough people to do those experiments and to invest the time and energy in getting it right.
Yeah, and
go ahead, John. We got some emails too. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah. So what I was going to say is, and I'll give a little bit of a plug for York. I mean, one of the big pushes for us has been, you know, in 1940, we were facing a very large challenge. And quite frankly, one of the things that came out of York in 1940 was something called the York Plan. So it wasn't Washington, D.C., it wasn't New York, it wasn't San Francisco. It was our community that saw the future coming, repivoted, retrained people in a matter of months. And the York Plan was adopted across the whole of the United States. And it was a small group of people making the decision that this was something that was necessary for us to rethink. And if we have time, I'm happy to go through what the York Plan was. But I mean, we've done this before. There have been large shifts that have happened in the past that a small group of people, I think we talked before, a small group of folks in Pennsylvania actually moved mountains. And we can do that. If there was ever a time that we were as connected, it's now. The key is, I think you're right, we're not speaking the same language. We've become a nation of movements and not mission. It's almost like we need our own space race. We need something like World War II, something large enough to get us all moving in that same direction. But I think you're right, Steve. We have a huge chance to get this right, and right in a way that can level the playing field for Americans and folks all over the world.
Email from Jeffrey says, is there any research that helps policymakers coordinate immigration needs with worker needs? I don't expect our national leaders to actually use the information for a reasoned discussion, but we voters ought to understand. Also, AI in part aims to eliminate repetitive and mundane tasks. Isn't it the case that a certain percent of just of us is really well suited to that kind of work? Can AI go too far? Let me bring Professor Hanover in. Do you want to answer that question, sir?
Which question? Which of the
Well, let's start with.
I don't think I have much to say about the first one, but this. The AI, as was pointed out earlier by one of the other guests, I think if a job could be completely automated, it probably should be, and then people are free to focus on the. The more interesting jobs. There's actually some years ago I read a report. I forget where it was, but a study that was done actually identified unmet needs, social needs and other societal needs where there is work to be done, but nobody is currently doing that, and those kinds of jobs would actually require something close to general human intelligence. And so there are these other jobs. So I'm not sure I'm answering that
okay.
question.
Okay. No, I think you are. Steve, with the immigration issue, obviously, is one of the top issues that we're focusing on in this country right now. I think the point that the listener is making is that wouldn't some of these... We've heard the argument that many American workers won't take, agricultural jobs because low pay, it's hard work. Isn't there the potential that some of those jobs that are filled by immigrants right now will be filled by robots?
Absolutely. I mean, actually, there's been stuff in the press in the last few days around actually automation and agriculture. Immigration policy, trade policy, domestic labor policy. In the end, it's we need an overall approach that's guided by the kind of mission that John talked about, where let's get what we sometimes call a New Deal for a New Economy, or let's pull together around taking advantage of the opportunities associated with artificial intelligence and robots, but also making sure that particular workers and families and communities are not victims of those changes. Broadly speaking, that's the challenge, and it's a solvable challenge. When you come to creating jobs, I mean, for example, In our report, we try to say, so far the debate about what to do about artificial intelligence and its potential impact on jobs has been framed a little bit by two extremes. One extreme is there's folks that I say have tech guilt in Silicon Valley who think they may have been personally responsible for coming up with these disruptive technologies, and then there's not going to be enough paid work to go around. So they want to create a universal basic income. Detached from whether or not people work, which is not a very American idea, and would be pretty expensive. And then on the opposite extreme, you have the kind of free market view, which is that it's technology and markets, and we can't and shouldn't do anything about it, right? We think there's a vast array of policies, from lifting wages to promoting apprenticeship and other kinds of workforce training that make people resilient and enable them to shift from one set of skills to another, to strengthening the balance between workers and employers on the part of workers, so mm-hmm. that distribution is different, to tax policy. But one of the other policies is we do think, in the end, shorter work time and things like public employment creation, Civilian Conservation Corps 2.0, or the arts program that people don't know about that went along with that in the 1930s, caregiving, infrastructure, the arts, customer service. There are a whole range of areas where...
Can I add a few things? Sorry. These were some reasons, some suggestions for why AI would not greatly displace a lot of humans. Rising incomes or rising prosperity around the world. Aging around the world. You know, we talked about healthcare.
Right.
The population, especially here in the United States and here in Pennsylvania, is aging. A lot more needs that will be created. The need to develop and deploy technologies. Investment in infrastructure, meaning that we're talking about real estate, buildings, and bridges. People do that for the most part, not robots. There are some jobs, but for the most part, those are jobs that are created for humans. Changes in the energy mix, decreasing amounts of unpaid labor in the global workforce. These are all things that have to be considered as part of the future. We only have a couple minutes left. I want to get Russell in Harrisburg in. Russell, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Earlier, a comment was made about the transition of Pittsburgh's economy from an industrial economy to an eds and meds economy, which is probably true that it's grown the local economy. But for average workers, right, who maybe somebody who would typically work in a steel mill is now working in a hospital, those jobs are actually lower paying jobs the big difference is that workers have less voice in the work that they do. And it presents the question of, as the economy transitions, what policies enable workers to have the same type of voice that they built as our industrial economy grew over the last century in the new transition economy. And regardless of what of the role of automation, if workers don't have a voice in their work and a voice in our overall economy that has enough power to ensure that they have their share, they're not going to get that.
Thank you very much for your call. We only have about a minute left. Steve?
I'll do that really quickly. I mean, most jobs today are actually in the services, and they're actually in the what we call the non-mobile services. They're services like retail or restaurants or caregiving that have to be near where the customer is. We know an even bigger share of the low-wage jobs. The bottom line is those people now are typically paid $8, $9, $10 an hour. If workers had a real right to unionize, like, let's say, the building trades do, and you could lift up all of retail or all of supermarkets or all of caregiving or all of healthcare, starting at UPMC in Pittsburgh, then we could get back a strong middle class. That's the kind of conversation we've got to have. If you do it right, you have more committed workers, lower turnover, folks that you can train better, you can improve the services they deliver to customers. Again, you can have a wonderful combination, like you do in the unionized building trades, actually.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. I mean, this has been an interesting conversation. I can tell from comments we're getting from our listeners that it has them thinking. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll be discussing the outbreak of measles, about 10 states across the country where that's happened. Some other programs coming up here in the next week or so on Smart Talk. Talk about a shortage of workers, a severe shortage of truck drivers. Also, the 40th anniversary of Three Mile Island, a month-long project here on WITF that we'll be talking about that 40th anniversary of the accident at Three Mile Island. Have a good day. I'm Scott Lamar. We'll